Good morning. Thank you so much for tuning in to 91.9 WDRT Public Radio. You're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rattay. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Oh, okay. The weather's a little... yeah.
Could be colder.
Yes, it could be colder. Could be sunnier.
That's true, too. So today we're going to talk about reactive eating.
Reactive eating. What the heck is that?
Yeah. For every action, there is a reaction.
That's correct.
Is all eating reactive eating?
It's reactive to what?
Reactive to what? Hunger.
Reactive to hunger, for sure.
Cues, right? If I see something on television, I might actually have hunger that I didn't have 5 seconds before.
Yes.
If I see a delicious ice cream sundae.
I would say part of the goal of a good, healthy diet, I think, is not to be a reactive eater.
To be proactive.
To be a proactive eater, to be the opposite.
Okay.
Yes, so to do things before you get reactive. Mm-hmm. Right. So you can't have the reaction without something that initiates that. I think. I don't know. Right? So you drive down the road and you see McDonald's. And McDonald's, it's yellow and red. And the food industry knows this. Yellow and red stimulates the appetite.
Huh.
They know this.
They know this.
They spent billions of dollars to understand how to get in our brain and get us to stop and buy and eat and do this kind of thing.
So why is Culver's blue?
I don't know. Culver's is like, they're not following the rules.
Okay.
Anyways, so how are you resistant to McDonald's? So how do you drive by McDonald's? How do you say, well, you know, McDonald's, I don't need to stop. And why do people stop? I don't think anybody would say that McDonald's is healthy.
Right. They don't put it in their day planner. Hey, by the way, make sure you catch a good lunch at McDonald's
for
tomorrow.
Sure.
Right.
I think everybody would agree on that.
I have to say, when I drive by, I have memories of high school because that's what I almost ate exclusively during lunch once I could drive because my high school allowed you to drive off campus to get lunch. 2 burgers and an order of fries and probably a soda. I try not to remember that part. But so I can actually taste the fries as I drive by, right? In my mind's eye, so to speak. But then my logic kicks in and I say, I haven't had McDonald's since high school. Why would I start now? So, you know, it's kind of logic overriding for me. I don't know.
So the logic does override. So when does a logic not override?
Do you
understand that
logically
we can say it's not good for us, it's not healthy.
Right.
Do I even like it? Right? Or
If I was really hungry and I was really busy and I knew I could go through the drive-thru quickly. Now, mind you, I personally still wouldn't. I would probably go to Culver's before I went to McDonald's because I've heard they put something in the McDonald's fries that make you want more, and that freaks me out. But, I think if I were that's reactive, right? I'm starving. I need to get something right now.
Exactly. So, in other words, you need to not be starving when you drive by McDonald's or not even... kind of starving, or even to the point like, oh, I remind myself because it's yellow and red that, oh, I am hungry, and oh, I should stop, and oh, I haven't eaten for a while. Yes, so the idea is how do you prevent that? How do you prevent that from happening? And then your logical brain will take over and say, oh, well, I don't need to stop at McDonald's. Yes, it's cheap, but yeah, I know what it tastes like. I know how I feel afterwards. I would say that's a strong one for me personally. Yes, I mean, I've eaten enough. A fair share of bad food,
yeah,
and I know how it makes me feel. And then it's just a matter of, do I want to feel that way? Drinking alcohol, right, for me is
sure.
a problem. Right? Mm. So it's just one of those things. I can choose to drink alcohol, but I can tell you the 3 effects that are going to happen because of that. And then I got to just weigh the risks and benefits and say, is that worth it? Is it not worth it? What do I get from this? Right? It's risk and benefit, constant, the logical brain.
Right.
Assessing that. But the logical brain will turn off when you're in desperate mode, when you're in reactive eating mode. Right? So reactive eating is a proper response to the sense that, hey, I'm hungry. And hungry being potentially different things. I think there's 3 different kinds of hunger. Maybe there's 10 kinds of hunger. I remember a New York Times article. I think they probably reprint this every Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Yeah, they have the 8 stages of overeating or the 10 stages of overeating. I can't
there
remember.
There are 10?
It's something like that. I mean, I
wow.
think it's there's a picture for each one, right? So they have a little icon for each one. I mean, I have the article saved somewhere. I like it, but I would imagine they recycle that. Like, what
every
are the different
year.
Kinds of overeating?
Yeah.
they're talking about overeating. Maybe I'm talking about the hunger that drives us to
overeat.
Yes. So yeah. What kinds of hunger are there? Is it just like, oh, I'm hungry, I need to eat, but what are triggers for that, or what are patterns? What do you think?
Well, I know that some of it is wanting to be on a schedule. So sure. Some of it's noon. I should eat now.
Yeah.
And that sort of bleeds into, I have to go to work, so I should eat before I leave for work, that kind of thing. So
yes.
scheduled hunger, I guess. And then
I'll call that habit. Maybe it's habit, mm-hmm. routine, rhythm, you know, this kind of thing. And again, I'm sorry, I'm interjecting here. So when you eat before you go to work, you know that if I do that, then I won't have to stop while I'm working to eat, and this is going to help prevent something from happening down the road.
Correct.
That's proactive eating. You're doing something to prevent the reactive eating 2, 3, 4 hours later.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, especially if you're, like when I clean houses, I definitely want to eat beforehand because I don't want to have to stop and eat.
Yes,
right?
Yes. So there's a habit of kind of the rhythm of your life, and this is what we do. And I would say that's a strong motivator. I mean, that's why we eat, well, I don't know if that's why we eat breakfast, but part of the sense of that, right? I mean,
yes.
How long can we go? And we do that, and then we know that that's going to get us through the morning.
Correct.
Kind of thing.
Right.
Okay, so that's one hunger.
So then there's that, what we were talking about, that I've waited too long and now it's a desperate situation. I need to eat.
Yeah, desperate. So desperate would be, let's clarify that a little bit more. I think there's maybe two different kinds of desperation.
Okay.
I think there's the actual energy component of that. Like, I need energy.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have enough energy. Right? And in biochem land, we call that the energy is ATP, adenosine triphosphate.
God bless you.
Whatever.
And that is the feeling of, I'm either going to take a 2-hour nap because I can't sustain this, or I'm going to eat something.
Correct. So okay. If you don't have enough energy, your body's going to compensate for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's going to be, your brain's going to get into energy-seeking mode. Like,
right.
I need energy. Like, your brain's not going to be processing logical facts. Well, I mean, it does, but you're going to be sidelined a bit. Like, well, wait a minute. I don't have enough glucose to do all these things that I have to, like, change my behavior to get some glucose or get ATP.
Correct.
Put it that way. So that's a real thing, right? Energy.
Mm-hmm.
And how we access energy in the body is different. I'm going to tell you, we have the same biochemistry, but how it actually works is individual from each person to each person. I think we could talk about obesity and all sorts of things being, on some level, your ability to access the energy that you have stored in your body.
Okay.
Yes, I mean,
yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, very simple mm-hmm. here, but regardless, so perhaps some people may need energy quicker than other people, perhaps.
Sure, and we call that, we usually say you have fast metabolism.
Yeah, fast metabolism, slow metabolism, and that's just kind of a word we use, and what does that mean, right? How do we measure that? We can measure the oxidation rate. That's the rate at which we oxidize carbohydrates and that kind of thing, but it gets kind of really,
I think most lay people think of it as, I've digested my food so quickly that I'm already hungry again, whereas someone else can eat the same amount of food and it can burn longer.
Yeah, I think what it is how, what do we do with that energy once we absorb it? And we'll get to this, too, about how important it is to slow down the rate at which it's absorbed into the body.
Sure.
Because mm-hmm. that's going to give you a more long-drawn-out energy profile
sustained.
Rather than something that's really quick.
Right. And now, is that another desperate, really quick energy that's
down? Now we got to talk about the hangry part.
Yeah.
Yes. So there's perhaps maybe it's just a spectrum of what that energy need is. Do I have an immediate need for energy? Is it sort of a need for energy? The hangry is sort of this sort of desperation piece, right? And I think that also food will act as a drug. I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just saying
that all the time. I've got a lot of stuff to do, I have some green tea or some black tea, and I do tend to use that caffeine as a drug.
Yeah, and we do the same thing with glucose, right? We do the same thing with carbohydrates. We'll spike our serotonin levels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just the idea that when you eat carbohydrates, actually quick carbohydrates, which we're going to talk about, like maybe not the good thing, but they boost your serotonin.
Right.
And you boost your serotonin, you feel better. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing. Yes. I mean, you're getting that from a food. It's just the question is, you're using it for that effect, or you're using for the quick effect rather than the long drawn out, I actually need some energy to last for 4 hours, rather than I need energy to rescue me because I'm in a really bad place right now.
Right. And so I'm feeling the need to define drug that we were just mentioning because that tends to have a negative connotation.
Yeah,
but what we're really talking about is alchemy. We're using a substance that is coming into our body that is changing the structure, right? And it's changing how we're reacting. I mean, it's not like a drug, right?
Yeah, alchemy. Maybe that's perhaps more more palatable, yes.
Okay, thank you. That makes you feel better.
It makes you feel better with the green tea, yes, or the caffeine that you... It's the alchemical response.
Yeah, wait a minute. It's not a drug, really. It's magic. It's alchemy.
Yeah, it's a drug.
Okay.
Let's just say the drug is there's a spectrum of the influence on the right. How strong of an effect does it have on your biochemistry?
Right.
I mean, if I want to take a side note, we can talk all about herbal medicine. Yes, herbal medicine can have an effect like a drug, and some herbs work much stronger than other herbs. Yes, but they still don't. I shouldn't even say they don't. But there's a wide spectrum of when does it become like a controlled substance? Like that's something we have to be aware of, right? There's a whole spectrum of things that it alters your physiology, and it may alter your physiology just slightly or a slightly more or really aggressive. And it tends to be drugs when we talk about medications, that kind of thing. I mean, they have strong physiological effects. There's
right.
no balancing in that, right? Perhaps with herbs, you're going to have more of a nuanced, balanced effect, and then you combine them together. And there's certainly an alchemy, art piece of combining things. And I'm
there
not sure there's... But
you said alchemy again. That's all I heard.
The alchemy of, you know, of combining, right?
Right.
Anyways, so there was the hungers, yes? So there's kind of that hangry, and a hangry would just be that definition of, you know, reactive eating, because now you are driven right this moment to get some energy in your body because you're in desperation mode versus... Hey, you know, I'm kind of hungry. I could probably put it off for an hour or so, and maybe I need to think about where I'm going to get my meal, but I'm not like driven. It's not like taking charge of my frontal lobe to say, seek food, seek food, seek food.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so there's I guess the definition, right? So reactive eating comes in that. So the way to deal with that is to be a proactive eater so you're not reactive.
Right.
And we could really say this is reactive hypoglycemia. Yes. I mean, that would be a word or perhaps a diagnosis, which is kind of problematic because it's hard to diagnose. Yes, so we could say somebody is reactive hypoglycemic. So that would mean we talked about this with wearing a continuous glucose monitor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So somebody that's diabetic or, you know, they test their blood sugar. So they draw their blood and they get a number and they're like, oh, my blood sugar is at 88 or my blood sugar is at 120 or what have you. And again, the goal is to have that blood sugar at 80. Right. I mean,
okay.
That's the quote-unquote norm. So the more you stray from that, the more quote-unquote abnormal you are. But what's important on that is the body is constantly regulating. So if you're below 80, it's turning on things in your body to get you back up to 80.
Mm-hmm.
If you're at 120, it's turning on other mechanisms to get you back down to 80.
Got it.
Yes. So there's
homeostasis.
Homeodynamics is a better word, actually, because you don't go to 80 and stay. It's like there's this constant flux.
Yeah.
And understand that the closer you are to 80, so if you're at 88 and you're coming down to 80, and I'm generalizing this significantly here, that's going to be kind of a slower response, or your body's not going to turn on all these pathways compared to if you're at 160 and now you need to come down to 100.
Sure.
Yes? Because understand, if we have elevated blood glucose, our body's quote-unquote happy. We have the glucose available. But what's the problem with elevated blood glucose?
That's when you're going to start coming into... I mean, you need to... What's
so elevated blood glucose, what's the disease associated with that?
Diabetes.
Yes, diabetes.
Right.
So diabetes is when you have elevated blood glucose and it doesn't come back down to 80.
Correct.
Yes. Now understand there's a compartmental issue here. So compartments. So blood glucose means it's in your bloodstream. Yes, it's in your bloodstream, and it's there. It's available for your cells to take. Oftentimes, we talk about diabetes being starving in a sea of plenty. So the sea of plenty means that you have plenty of glucose in your bloodstream.
You just can't.
But you can't use it. You can't get it from the bloodstream to the cell. And the cell is where you need it. Yes,
right.
The bloodstream is just, you know, for all intents and purposes, the carrier, right? It's there. It's available.
Sure.
So diabetics often have a hard time managing the glucose that they have. So that if they eat a lot of carbohydrates, their blood sugar goes up, and their mechanism, their control piece, which is insulin and some other things too that play a role in that, to get that back down to 80 doesn't work very well.
Okay.
Right? And
okay.
Type 1 diabetic doesn't have any insulin. So they don't have that hormone to help regulate that. They need the insulin. Type 2 diabetic has insulin. It's just losing its effectiveness. Right, so they have a hard time getting back down to 100.
Okay.
Or, I'm sorry, to 80.
80. So now, I mean, my uncle has diabetes of some kind, and there's always a danger of being too low as well. That's usually what
I hear
about.
Right, because that's when now you're dosing insulin. So somebody that's, you know, generally a type 2 diabetic won't be on insulin to begin with because they still have insulin. It's just they're insulin resistant. Not insulin deficient.
Mm-hmm.
So type 1 diabetic is insulin deficient. That's more autoimmune. That's usually, I mean, not immediate, but the generally like, oh, you need insulin. We're going to start giving you insulin. And so it's insulin, the injections that you use, right? Mm-hmm. So now you're injecting yourself with the hormone to get that blood sugar from 160 down to 80.
Okay, got
it. And there's different kinds of insulin. Yes, short acting, quick acting. So now it becomes alchemy, sorry. But some combining where you're now trying to figure out what's the right amount of different kinds of insulin that I do when I eat a certain meal or how I do this, right? So that's what diabetics will get sort of good at. I mean, they'll figure out how to manage
and
that.
Regulate.
But understand that if you take too much insulin, yes, so if your blood sugar is at once again, you take way too much, what happens? Then you go low again.
Yes.
Now you're back into reactive hypoglycemia, but that was caused by you taking too much insulin.
Right, okay.
That's a drug-induced state, but I'm saying that you can see that state in a normal human being, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that's got reactive hypoglycemia, you're going to see that same kind of dips in the highs and lows, the roller coaster thing that happens as just normal day-to-day function.
Mm-hmm.
But what's important here is that generally, if your blood sugar is at 160, you don't know it. Like, I don't know it. If we eat a bunch of carbohydrates, so you eat a high carbohydrate meal, high glycemic index, we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do that, your blood sugar will go really high. It's not like you're saying, like, wow, you know, I think my blood sugar is a little high. Yeah?
Right.
We don't have any sense of that. Now, diabetics that have been diabetic for a while will know that, right? They'll kind of have a sense that their blood sugar is really high because they've been there many times, but that's kind of, I think they learn that it's not just like immediate.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing driving us if our blood sugar is high, our blood glucose is high, right? We're not like turning on to say, oh, we need energy because we got plenty of energy, right? So the brain's not necessarily involved in that. There's no problem. It's just that could kill us if it stays elevated for a long period of time, right? Certainly damaging in the body.
And our liver, the liver? And
yeah, the liver, the pancreas. So the pancreas secretes insulin, and then the liver is the organ that's playing a huge role in helping regulate that blood glucose, whether it's too low or whether it's too high. So the liver works on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Really important organ,
yeah,
from my perspective, yes.
Yeah.
So again, you don't have any symptoms when you're really high glucose, but you have lots of symptoms when you're low glucose.
Right. Right? That's
then you're desperate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So again, I like to look at I call it the blood glucose roller coaster.
Okay. Right?
So the idea is that again, we're trying to regulate at 80. And if you're at 40, it's an issue.
Right. Right?
And the question is when do the symptoms start to occur? Yeah. So it's the symptoms, meaning the symptoms of hangry or the symptoms of I need to eat now,
mm-hmm,
right? So it's a blood sugar roller coaster. So it's like riding I know Valley Fair in the Twin Cities, right? The wild thing, right? I love that ride, right? Go up really high, and then you come way far down, yes?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't ride those.
Okay, it's fun to ride. I'm an epinephrine guy, right? I like that hit. But you don't want your blood glucose doing that.
No.
And understand, for all intents and purposes, you can't go really low unless you went high.
Right.
So this is important. There's a difference between the wild thing, the big roller coaster, or the kiddie roller coaster, right? The mild thing. So the mild thing is you go up a little bit and then you come down, but it's not so far down.
Mm-hmm.
Not so far up, not so far down. That's what we want with our blood glucose.
Correct.
We don't want to be this huge fluctuation because, again, we don't have any symptoms for the most part when we're at the top of the roller coaster. We have symptoms as we start to come down and when we start to bottom out.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if we really get technical about it, it's not even that your blood sugar has to be 40 that you're symptomatic. I'll just give this example. So I've had patients that come in and they have a blood glucose monitor, and you know, we'll have a conversation. I'll be like, oh, if you're feeling desperate or you're feeling hangry, take your blood sugar, right? Tell me what your blood glucose is. And I've heard this numerous times. They come in and they say, oh, I took my blood glucose and it was 98 and I was desperate. I'm like, 98? Wait, that's actually elevated. That's on the high end. Like, that's a head scratcher. I would think, oh no, you're at 60 or you're at 40 or some desperate place like that. But no, they're at 98. And I scratch my head and I like try to figure that out. But honestly, what's important is probably where they were 5 minutes before the 98 and 10 minutes before the 98 and 20 minutes before the 98, right? So this is where you only take one blood glucose reading, it doesn't give you the context.
Right.
Because if I had a continuous glucose monitor, right, that's somebody that's wearing one of those devices that continuously monitors their glucose, so then we can see the ups and downs, and then we can see the path of the roller coaster, right? Then we would see, oh, they were actually higher and they're starting to fall.
Right.
And
it's the falling that's happening. That 98 was a significant fall from the 130 that they were at.
Yeah, it's
15
the
minutes
slope.
Before.
It's the slope of that line, right?
Yeah.
That's really important. And one reading doesn't tell me that. Whereas that's the value of a continuous glucose monitor, because it gives you sort of that feedback to say, oh, I'm high or I'm low, or what's going on, and how do I sort of manage that?
Okay. Well, we'll take a moment here to thank you all for tuning in, spending time with us here at 91.9 WDRT in Viroqua Public Radio. You're currently tuned in to The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rattay and his nutrition sidekick, who so gratefully learns something new every time, Christina DeRocher. I wanted to let you know about a 12-lecture series that Paul Rattay is putting on at the Commons on Jefferson Street in Viroqua. He's actually on his 6th lecture now. He's halfway through. And the next one will be Saturday, June 10th. The title is Refined Carbohydrates: How to Identify and Avoid Empty Calories. These are free. The lecture series are free. They're the first Saturday of every month? Second Saturday of every month. My apologies. And you'll have an opportunity to ask health questions of any stripe in the first half an hour. So this is from 8:30 until 10 in the morning at the Commons on Jefferson Street this Saturday, June 10th. Thank you so much. All right, we're back.
Thank you.
Yeah. Little plug.
The plug, the early early Saturday morning. I'm not getting up in the morning. Anyways, so again, it's interesting. So refined carbohydrates fit right back into what we're talking about here, right? So reactive, you know, now I've already taught that class. By the time this is aired, it's already gone. But then the refined carbohydrates are, how does that now affect that blood sugar roller coaster, right? Because now that's the key issue. How do we stay off the roller coaster? How do we get on the mild thing instead of riding the wild thing?
Okay, yeah?
And
yes.
How do we manage that? Let's first talk about a simple thing that people do to avoid getting hangry. What is it that they do? Do you know?
I think eat regularly.
Yeah, eat regularly. So they graze, right? So this is grazing.
Mm-hmm.
So
just
think
to avoid about it. Avoid any ups or downs. Just keep eating.
Avoid the downs. So it's like they stay in the ups.
Oh, they
so
stay
they
in the
stay
ups.
At
grazing
the top,
is staying at the ups.
Stop,
because,
top of the mountain. They're okay. Constantly at the top of the mountain. They never get to the valley.
Even if you're eating healthfully, grazing
yeah,
is
sure.
still...
Well, grazing just means you're eating more times,
mm-hmm.
right? So you're saying, I'm going to eat every 2 hours, and if I eat every 2 hours, I don't get hangry. That's true. I'm not debating that. Yeah,
right.
I mean, I'm not saying don't graze. Grazing is a way to do that. The issue from my perspective is, what does grazing lead to, and what are you grazing on?
Right.
Right? So this is the concept of eating occasions, just to put this in perspective.
Right.
So they did a... So they have the NHANES, that's the National Health Exam. I don't know what it stands for. It's the survey that we do every 5 or 7 years in the United States, where we're collecting information, right? So they've done that, and they've asked eating occasions, right? So how many times a day do you eat? And back in 1977, right around that time frame, the average eating occasion was 3.5, meaning that we eat 3.5 meals a day. Or 3.5 times, I should say, not meals, 3.5 times, right? That's an occasion. It's not how much you ate. It's just how many times did you eat. So 3.5 would translate to, you know, 3 meals a day and 1 snack every other day.
Mm-hmm, the half.
Yeah, that's the half. What is it today? Well, what is it in 2003, 2006? That's the latest data that I have that reports that. It was 5.
Yeah. Right?
That's the median. So now we're eating 5 meals a day on average.
Right, or 5 times a day.
Correct. 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And are we eating 5 meals? Are we sitting down and eating 5 meals?
I hope not.
But yeah, I doubt that. Yeah. But what are we doing? We're snacking. Right, we're snacking. And in fact, some of those meals may not be meals any longer. It may be that we're just eating snacks throughout the day. We're snacking 4 times a day and eating 1 meal.
Hmm.
That's possible. We don't know, right? It's just how many times we eat. I don't think that's a sign of health.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, that's my bias here. That eating more frequently may lead you to eating more calories because you're eating more. You're opening the door to say, now it's time to eat. And the question is, what are you eating to stay out of the valleys?
Right.
Right. And what is available to us? What do we do? What kinds of foods do we eat to stay out of the valley?
I think it's snack food because that's convenient.
Yeah, snack food that's convenient.
Right. So it's usually packaged.
It's organic. It's good for me.
Right.
What kind of effect does it have on your blood glucose? But again, keep in mind that you're trying to boost your blood glucose. That's what you want. Yes, mm-hmm. You want to stay at the top of the valley. Or I'm sorry, the top of the mountain. But the problem is staying at the top of the mountain all along is also keeping your blood glucose potentially elevated, or there's this constant flux that's going on, right? You spike it, it comes down. You spike it, it comes down. You just don't let it come down too far.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, so that's one way that you can prevent that, right? Prevent the reactive eating. That for sure, it works. But perhaps we need to look at what are you eating in order to prevent that? And do you have to eat 5 meals a day or 5 times a day to do that? Or is it possible that you could do that within 3 meals a day and potentially not need to snack on things? I mean, if you really push me against the wall and said, what is the number one problem? I mean, I'm going to tell you it's the frequency in which we eat is the major problem. If we basically said you have a 30-minute window 3 times a day, you can choose the times, right? I'm not going to choose them for you. So let's say it's breakfast, it's lunch, it's dinner. You have from 8 to 8:30, 12 to 12:30, and 6 to 6:30. And you can eat whatever you want in those 30 minutes. I don't care. You want to drink soda? You can drink soda. But it's within a 30-minute period of time. That's the only time you can eat. If we did that, I think you'd see a significant improvement in our health, even if we're drinking soda and eating French fries and doing this. I think the snacking and the eating occasions really get us into trouble because they open up the door to eating lots of other things.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have a really restrained eating pattern, right, a restrained time frame to eat, you're going to have to start to prioritize that, and then you don't have anything to rescue you in between. Mm-hmm. So then you'd have to be like, oh, wow, what am I going to actually? I have to actually eat a meal, and there's protein, and there's fat, and there's carbohydrates. I can't just rely on the crappy fat carbohydrate mix that's out there from the snack, you know, the food industry, that's what I'm using as my rescue food.
Right. In other words, you have to be careful what you eat during those 3 times a day because you're not going to offset it.
Perhaps. And even if you do not, if you just choose to eat snack food in one of those 30-minute windows, you're going to find you're in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And then
almost.
You're like, oh, I don't have anything to rescue me. I got to wait till the next meal. And wow, I'm in a bad place. Oh, well, maybe I have to change my behavior.
Right. Right?
Maybe I got to get a little bit more protein in there or whatever. But
I
think that's a big problem with our industrialized food complex that we live in this country, right? We have food available to us every single moment. There's no struggle. It's available. It's available everywhere. It's easy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Hmm. Interesting. And I'm also thinking that, you know, everyone's organs are singing as you say this, and they're saying, we could actually just, you know, have a break, because I think that's good for the organs of your body too, is not to be working on digesting all day long.
Our biochemistry is based on feast or famine. We can adapt, or I mean, that's been the our experience as human beings.
More than the modern
more
convenience.
Than a constant consumption all of the time. And and actually our biochemistry is better evolved to deal with famine than it is to deal with feasting. Because think of it. So you may have a famine or you may not eat for 2 days. And then all of a sudden you have you kill an animal, right? Or you're hunting. I mean, look at traditional cultures and how they worked, right? Mm-hmm. And how they ate and how they filled in the gaps when they didn't have an animal to consume, right? And where they eat tubers or whatever. And they knew that, right? They were living in, in
communion with
communion with their geography. Mm-hmm. They knew exactly the situation that they were in. I mean, we do nothing like that. Well, I shouldn't say we do nothing. We do that, right? We go to the farmer's market and that kind of thing. But we still eat bananas and we eat, blueberries in February. And those aren't coming from anywhere around here.
Yeah.
That's not adapting to our individual geography.
Right.
But we didn't have those conveniences before. But those conveniences have, I think, had a effect on our health.
This is off topic, but we also ate more of the animal. There was more of a balance of the whole thing.
Oh yeah, you're not wasting any of the animal because that animal was. I mean, the amount of work and what you needed to do to capture and kill that animal and do that. That's there's a lot of respect given instead of kind of what we do today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like chicken feet, ew. I mean, chicken feet, great to make soup, good collagen source. I mean, and you can buy chicken feet really inexpensive.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants them.
Right.
Chicken liver, same thing. Chicken heart. Mm-hmm. Oh, but I want the chicken breast.
Right.
So the breast is more expensive, and then the other parts are, don't cost very cheap. That used to be with chicken thighs, too. Chicken thighs used to be less expensive. I don't know if you... I've been around the block a long time, and I've seen the price of chicken thighs go up because as they become more popular, the price goes up because people buy them instead of like, I only want chicken breast.
Hmm.
So sort of as that fat hypothesis, the lipid hypothesis has shifted a little bit, like
sure.
Perhaps maybe fat isn't bad for us, and perhaps I don't need to just eat chicken breast all the time. Maybe chicken thighs are okay because I can cook them. They're more tolerant to cooking. I'm not going to overcook them. They taste better. And, but then the price has gone up.
Sure. Supply and demand.
Supply and demand. That's how it works. Anyway, so back to the, staying out of that valley. Yes. So again, grazing is one way to get around that. But the other piece is then being a proactive eater. So proactive eating means that now you're doing things so that you don't go to the top of the roller coaster and you don't come crashing down. So if you never go to the top of the wild thing, you're never going to, that slope of the line, the slope of which you're coming down is going to be much less, right? Again, the mild thing is kind of slow, gradual descent rather than an immediate drop.
And so that's good for your organs, and it's good for your blood glucose, and it's also good for your choices probably, because you might have time to slow down and make something that's more nutritious than just throwing a candy bar down the gullet because you're in a desperate situation, right?
Yeah, and guess what happens to your hunger when you do that? You're just not hungry,
mm-hmm.
or you're not desperate. You may be like, I'm kind of hungry. I mean, I'll use my experience. And again, this is just my own anecdotal. This is not me saying you have to do this. I don't eat breakfast, yes? So I definitely am an intermittent faster. I haven't eaten breakfast in 10 years, right? I mean, I eat breakfast once in a while.
Off and on, right, yeah.
Rarely.
Rarely.
Once a month, maybe? I don't know. But I don't eat breakfast. So that's the aspect that there's a lot more time in between there to just kind of say, okay, now I'm allowing my organs to repair and rebuild. But I actually find that I feel better. My energy, my brain function is much better with me not eating breakfast than eating breakfast. Even if I don't eat any carbohydrates, I still notice that I get hungry when I eat breakfast. I get hungry around noon. Whereas if I don't do that, I don't get hungry.
Yeah.
So it's just a sort of a difference.
Explain that, though. Why is that? Because you got your digestive juices flowing and now they're...
I don't think it's anything to do with digestion because it's basically off when you're not eating.
Yeah.
But so I'm using the energy that I've stored in my body and I'm able to use that. I mean, I'm just telling you my own personal experience. I mean, I've heard lots of stories, but I only know what it's like to live in my skin. So just the sense is that I really don't get hungry. Yeah, so it goes on. So that means I'm getting energy somewhere.
Oh, yeah. No, that's understandable. But what does it mean when you eat breakfast and then you're hungry? You know what I'm saying? You're able to fast. I know you well enough to know that you're actually able to fast till around 2 in the afternoon. My question is, if you do eat breakfast, why are you hungry at noon. Why can't you then still fast until 2 as you usually do?
Interesting. So that's the million-dollar question, yes. But I think it's because you're now starting to, when you eat, you turn your body into, now I'm in digestion mode. And let's say digestion mode maybe lasts an hour, right? Again, that's going to vary a little bit from person to person and the kind of food you eat.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're in digestion absorption. And then once it's absorbed, now your body has to choose something to do with that. And it's kind of your liver, not only your liver, but your liver's going to say, oh, well, now I have these extra calories. I have extra fat. I have extra carbohydrate. I have extra protein. What am I going to do with those things? Am I going to store it? And what am I going to store it as? Am I going to store it as fat? Am I going to store it as glycogen? How much do I need for energy right now? How much do I save for later? So that's all going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think like, oh, well, you're fine. You don't need to eat again for that. But that's processing that's going on. And it still may be that based on the function of your liver, that's to the point that you're like, oh, well, now I actually need more food, even though I'm still processing what I ate before. I mean, I'm trying to explain this. I'm not actually sure, right?
Yeah,
I'm just kind of guessing. Well, I guess it would be more of an educated guess, right?
Uh-huh.
A biochemical guess. But
right. For
all intents and purposes, it's just that something's happening to come in there and start to say, I'm hungry. Whereas perhaps I'm hungry when I'm fasting, but I'm on this kind of
even keel
because I'm not fluctuating high and low. When you eat a meal, you're going to get fluctuations on that,
mm-hmm.
right? You're going to automatically fluctuate that. I mean, my experience is I could eat all fat and protein for breakfast and I'll still get hungry, even if I don't eat any carbohydrates. I eat a keto breakfast.
Yeah.
I will still get hungrier quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even necessarily the carbohydrate in that does that. But that's just my experience. Other people, I will tell you, they say they skip breakfast and they want to, you know, strangle me by, you know, 11 a.m.
Sure.
Because it doesn't work for them.
Yeah.
So
sure.
It's not to say that that's the end-all be-all for everybody. But what that means is they have a hard time going without eating, yes? So they have a harder time to skip meals.
Sure.
And that's just their presentation, per se. But how do you then change that? How do you change the way so that you don't have to be a reactive eater or that you could potentially not eat breakfast? So I would say now you got to look at what you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
So now we got to pay attention to, well, carbohydrates, fats, protein, what's that right mix? What's that right fuel mix for my body to enable me to go longer without eating? So that's the intermittent fasting thing. I think don't just intermittent fast because you're intermittent fasting. Change what you eat so you're able to intermittent fast.
Right.
So you could say, hey, I can skip a meal. I could skip dinner and I'm okay.
Yeah.
Whereas I got people that they're not going to skip dinner.
Yes, yeah.
But they can't skip dinner, right?
No, yeah.
And that's a real thing, right? That's I'm listening to their symptoms. I mean, your body's not going to lie to you.
True.
You're going to force it. But that's just the idea that, okay, well, what do I have control over? Oh, perhaps what I put in the fuel tank and how I look at that. So this now gets into the whole concept of glycemic index and glycemic load and satiety index.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is a whole deal.
And just before we go into that, I'd like to thank you again so much for tuning in here to 91.9 WDRT, Viroqua Public Radio. I would like to tell you about Dr. Paul Rattay's 12 lecture series over the year. He's on his 6th lecture halfway through. The lecture series is called Obstacles to Cure. And on Saturday, June 10th, he will be talking about refined carbohydrates, how to avoid and identify empty calories. Probably easier to talk about how to identify them first and then how to avoid them. Anyway, these lectures are free, and you will have an opportunity to ask any health questions in the first half an hour. So on Saturday, June 10th, from 8:30 until 9, he'll have a Q&A, and then from 9 until 10, he'll talk about refined carbohydrates at the Commons on Jefferson Street in Viroqua. Thanks so much for tuning in. So, glycemic load,
and then satiety index.
Okay, here we go. Let's unpack these. It's so fascinating how, you know, since meeting you and talking about these things, I'm noticing how much we hear about things that we just don't unpack for ourselves. I mean, how many times have we heard about glycemic index? I'm familiar with the term, very familiar with the term, and I really didn't know what it meant. So it's really important to be looking at those things, I guess.
Still kind of nebulous, but you do know that you drink Coke and you drink it with friends. Yes, that's celebration is drinking Coke.
That's right.
You do know that, because
yes.
How many times have you seen that too? Yes.
Yeah, good point.
I'm just saying that's glycemic index is more complex, and we don't like complexity. Complexity is hard work for our brain. Mm-hmm. Just tell me what to eat.
I know.
I don't want to think.
I know.
Just, you know, let's just start there.
For all you listening out there, I do have to say that we do a pre-show warm-up, so to speak, and we get together and we chat. And I think almost every single time I ask Paul some detail about his diet, I'm mining him for information.
You get the bad things, too.
So when you eat at 2 and 7, what is it? What do you actually eat? And I'm taking notes and thinking, I'm going to try that. Yeah. It would be so much easier if we came with... a menu.
Yeah,
your body's like this, and this is what you should generally eat for the rest of your life. Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, but then you do it, and then you say, well, it doesn't work for me.
Well,
you got to experiment, right? It's
right.
Just constant experimentation.
And even if it does, we all know, I mean, if we're of a certain age, we all know that what worked for us in our teens and then worked for us in our 20s, 30s, that it changes even if we're the same, quote unquote, the same person, right?
Right. So perhaps we are more flexible in our metabolism the younger we are, and then we're not so flexible as we get older. So the indiscretions that we do earlier in life, we can't continue to do that. Drinking alcohol, I would put high on that list.
Right, yes. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, so glycemic index, glycemic load, satiety index. So glycemic index is basically looking at the quality of the carbohydrate that's in the food, and the quality of the food, right? Quality, not quantity. So quality meaning that how quickly does that food boost your blood glucose?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and
mm-hmm.
Understand if you're a reactive eater, if you're at the bottom of the roller coaster, you're looking for something to get you back up, and you want to get back up quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when you're hangry, what are you looking for? You want a chicken breast?
No.
Do you want to eat an avocado?
No.
What do you want?
Candy bar, piece of fruit.
Yep. A bagel.
Juice.
A bagel.
A
works
bagel.
Really good.
Yeah. Toast.
Toast.
Buttery toast with cinnamon.
Yes. So we want carbohydrate. Yes.
Yeah.
And we
yeah.
want basically a high glycemic index carbohydrate. We want to eat a carbohydrate or something that has a carbohydrate in it. Could have other things too. But we want that carbohydrate that's going to get our blood sugar from 40 to 120 really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That's glycemic index.
Okay.
Right? And understand that when they give you a number on that, generally, well, it is a percentage. So when they say the glycemic index of a bagel is 72, means it's 72%. 72% of what? 72% of what glucose would give you. So if you just did like crystalline glucose, right, or just straight glucose, that would be a glycemic index of 100.
Okay.
So everything is compared to
the pure
glucose.
And
it's interesting, there's some foods that are over 100, like a Clif Bar. Actually, I guess it depends on the kind of Clif Bar too, but Clif Bars have a glycemic index actually over 100. So I think it's like 120.
Huh. Wow.
Specifically designed, but what is a Clif Bar for?
Right, for that, when you know, you're hiking or you're biking or you're camping, right? They love to think about it in nature terms.
You're hanging from a cliff by one hand. That's Cliff. I mean, the guy who did start it, his name's Cliff, right? But he's hanging from a cliff by one hand, and he's got the Clif Bar in the other
and
hand.
And luckily
yes.
he opened it before he started climbing.
Yes, and understand that he needs that energy, and he needs it right now. He needs a lot of energy right now so that he can finish that climb.
Yes. Okay.
Appropriate use of a high glycemic index carbohydrate. Yes?
Yes, although I'm thinking about all the school children who bring it for lunch who maybe,
that's different, though.
Maybe don't need...
Exactly. So you're sitting in a classroom and you're saying, oh, I need some energy. What am I going to do? I'm going to eat a Clif Bar. Now you're going to flood your body with glucose, which may help you temporarily, but it's not going to stay there, and you're not even necessarily going to use that for physical activity. It's now just basically brain function, and now you're kind of overwhelming your metabolism with too much carbohydrate that's not, quote-unquote, appropriate.
And you don't know it.
And you don't know it because it gets you up quick and then you're fine.
Yeah.
But you don't understand that I stay up fine and then I start to drop again versus I'm climbing the cliff and I'm actually going to use that energy because I'm moving my muscles and doing things with it, right?
Right.
Appropriate versus inappropriate use. And again, this is a spectrum, yes? I mean, how much exercise did you do? I mean, how aggressive is it going to be? What was your heart rate at? I mean, those would be all the little intricacies that we would need to be able to prescribe you a carbohydrate, how many carbohydrates you need to eat. we can't do that. I mean, it's almost impossible.
Right.
So we'll never get that. So again, it's just like you've got to take your own cues to say what's valuable, what's not valuable.
Why can't the glycemic index, why can't you feel it the way you can feel caffeine? If you're going high...
Well, you feel it when you get back up. I mean, you'll feel if you eat a bagel.
Yeah.
If you're hangry, you eat a bagel, you feel better.
Right. But even if you've overdone it, you don't feel you've overdone it.
Do you know that you overdid it with caffeine? It takes a while still because
it
as you metabolize and clear that, then you'll be like, oh, it knocks you out or you get tired or you whatever, you know,
right.
sort of the
Or your heart is racing
effect.
For
yeah.
a while, yeah.
Right. And again, you're like, well, what was the right amount of caffeine? So that's like doing green tea, right? So it's a bit attenuated.
Mm-hmm.
So you attenuate it a little bit. So I'm not quite getting the same burst as a Red Bull.
Right.
But I'm still getting a little bit, right? So better that I get a little bit than way too much.
Mm-hmm.
But again, where are you at desperate mode?
Right. Yeah.
Again, this is, you know, the nuanced effect of, you know, we can't measure that.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard to like qualify that. Anyway, so glycemic index is how quickly it does that. So that's not necessarily a bad thing.
But
per
it's good
se.
To know. But it's really good to know.
Well, it's not a bad thing in that what it does, right?
Right.
This is what it does. The question is that appropriate or is it not appropriate? So let's look at what actually has high glycemic index.
Mm-hmm.
So glucose has the highest glycemic index. So this is the, I know we talked about this.
Well, you just said glucose has the highest. It has 100%,
yeah,
right?
Well, the Clif Bar is higher,
okay.
Yes. But let's just say that's the penultimate, right? So glucose.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, what's the best thing that you give to a diabetic who's now desperate that their blood glucose is really low?
Well, before our talk yesterday, I thought it was orange juice.
Yes, that's what we all know. So you give them orange juice, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And orange juice has a glycemic index of, I don't know, I think it's 40, maybe 50? Which is okay, right? It's moderate. Maybe it's 60. I don't know. But it's not 100.
Right.
You know, it's better to... So you want to get their blood glucose up immediately, right? This is like rescue mode. This is like worse than hangry. This is hangry times 10.
Mm-hmm.
And they may die.
Right,
yes?
Right.
So this is the idea that you give them orange juice. Orange juice will work, but it's got a glycemic index, let's just say 50,
mm-hmm.
versus giving them instant potatoes. If you put instant potatoes and mix them in water, that has a glycemic index basically of 100. Or you could give them that Clif Bar.
Amazing.
So the idea is that the instant carbohydrates will have a quicker effect on the blood glucose than orange juice does. But see, this leads to the myth that we all think about because we always talk about sugar. So we think, oh, my blood sugar's low. I need to eat sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And orange juice would be an example of sugar. We think, oh, there's sugar in the orange juice because it's sweet.
Right.
This is where we have to be very clear in our biochemistry that we're talking about glucose versus sucrose or glucose versus fructose.
Right.
So glucose is what's in instant potatoes. It's what's in rice. It's what's in wheat. It's what's in corn. It's not sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Starch. So that is basically potatoes are 100% glucose. They're not sweet. Fructose is the sweet component that's in the orange juice, right? So orange juice is sweet because it has glucose and it also has fructose, some mix between them.
Mm-hmm.
So sucrose, the plain white stuff that we use all the time, is by definition 50% glucose, 50% fructose. That's by definition. So half of it's glucose, which will spike your blood sugar. Fructose does not spike your blood sugar.
Amazing.
This is the myth. So somehow
yeah.
we always want to go towards sugar because we use the word blood sugar and we use sugar interchangeably, but we really need to say it's blood glucose. And we should say sugar, we should call it sucrose or we should call it fructose or what have you, just to differentiate that they're not the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what exactly is blood sugar then?
Blood sugar, when we say blood sugar, that's blood glucose.
Okay.
It's not blood fructose.
Okay.
And honestly, fructose does not belong in your bloodstream. In fact, your body fights to have fructose in the bloodstream. It's 10 times more toxic than glucose is. So your liver gets involved very quickly to make sure it processes, metabolizes all of the fructose that you consume. So again, back to the orange juice. Let's just say orange juice, for sake of argument here, is 50% fructose, 50% glucose.
Mm-hmm.
So that 50% glucose is going to go to your bloodstream. It's in your blood. Any cell in your body can use it. Great. That's going to raise your blood glucose.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then half of it's fructose. That fructose is not available to your cells. The fructose is going to your liver. Your liver is going to take that out. Well, it's going to, before it even gets into the bloodstream, the liver's going to basically, you know, quarantine it. I don't know if that's the right word. But take it out and then process it into something else. Now, the liver can turn it into glucose, But that's machinery, right? So your liver has to work to do that. But fructose is going to burden your liver. Or it's work on your liver to have to metabolize that. And again, fructose isn't just the bad guy either. So there's benefits of fructose, right? It actually restores your glycogen. They put it in sports drinks and things specifically to replenish, replete your glycogen, which is a good thing if you're exercising. But there again comes a level where you can do too much fructose. Now we get into the evils of sugar, or the evils, let's be clear, about fructose.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the point here is that fructose does not spike your blood glucose. And certainly not quickly, because your liver is going to have to turn that into glucose. That's going to take some time. That's not this. And we want, that's what we want.
Right.
So the myth is that foods that are sweet, that taste sweet, boost your blood sugar or boost your blood glucose. They do not.
So.
Or they're slower. They have a lower glycemic index than the starches do, right? Starch is non-sweet.
So chocolate cake is back on the menu.
Well, yeah, okay. So that's the example I gave, right? So chocolate cake. So I have a glycemic index that I made. I made it for patients, yes? So I can give them a sheet of paper and I say, okay, here's glycemic index and glycemic load. Immediately, they just value everything based on glycemic index, and they see chocolate cake has a glycemic index of 38, and they're like, and that's low.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I can eat chocolate cake. So I don't give the handout to anybody, yes, because then that validates their chocolate cake consumption, yes?
Right.
I mean, it's true. I'm not denying that, but I don't know that that's a healthy choice. It's just a choice to keep your blood glucose down.
Mm-hmm.
And so why is it that chocolate cake has a really low glycemic index? And potatoes have a high glycemic index.
There are less carbs, right?
There's a lot of carbs in chocolate cake.
Because of the flour.
Because of the flour. There's a ton of flour in that. Flour is going to have a really relatively high glycemic index.
So the eggs are balancing it out?
Oh, the eggs will do that? What else?
I guess there's dairy.
Milk,
maybe?
Or there's fat, or there's butter,
oh,
right?
Butter,
so then you put fat in it,
mm-hmm.
that's gonna lower it. Also, you put sugar in it. That chocolate cake has a fair amount of sugar in
it.
So adding the sugar means you're adding some fructose, and fructose actually has a lower glycemic index.
Okay, so it's all three of those, the butter, the eggs, and the sugar.
They're gonna have some effect to get that glycemic index down to 38, and the diabetic will say, oh, rock and roll, I can eat chocolate cake. And yes, it'll have less of an effect on their blood glucose in the short run, but there's still a tremendous amount of carbohydrate and there's a tremendous amount of balancing that's gonna go on. Yes, it won't spike their blood glucose.
Right.
But it's still gonna be a carbohydrate load on them that may have an effect over time.
Yeah, okay. And did you go over glycemic load
not
specifically?
Yet.
Okay.
We're getting there.
Okay.
So the other piece to this is looking at, for example, what diabetic candy? So I don't know if that's still around. I remember it in the 80s
too.
Or two,
mm-hmm.
maybe in the
bags,
90s.
You could buy bags of...
You're like, diabetic candy? That seems completely counterintuitive. How can I eat something sweet and not have it affect my blood glucose? Well, there you go, what I just said. If it's fructose, it does not spike the blood glucose. It has a low glycemic index. So those diabetic candies are just crystalline fructose.
Right. So was that kind of a marketing scheme, though? I mean, because couldn't you say that really all candy, because it's more sugar-based than it is carbohydrate-based, wouldn't spike your...
Well, they would use sugar. Sugar is half glucose, half fructose, so there's still a glucose component.
Okay, so
to
their
it.
Point is it's fructose.
Yeah, it's fructose. And now we're using fake sugars in it, too, right?
Yes.
So this is, you know, you can use saccharin, we can use erythritol, we can use monk fruit, we can use stevia, right? So there's all those things that would be in diabetic candies today. My point being is that crystalline fructose...
Less
is,
of a
which
glycemic.
Is really sweet, lower glycemic index.
Right.
Agave nectar is another example, right? If you buy that, it says low glycemic sweetener
because
it has a low glycemic index because it's basically all fructose, which means it's really sweet, which is fine on your blood sugar, blood glucose, but not so good on your liver function. Yeah, so now you're playing a different game, right? And my game, the rest of the story here, is that perhaps I take people off their carbohydrates because they're not carbohydrate tolerant, but if I'd seen them 10 years earlier, it would be like, wow, if you just cut back on your fructose consumption, you would allow your liver to function better, you wouldn't trash your liver as quick, and you'd be able to tolerate more carbohydrates later on in life. And now we don't have to start restricting your carbohydrate intake. But it's just further along in that disease process, if that makes sense. But anyway, so that's the why it's important to ration fructose. We'll talk about that with refined carbohydrates next month.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's glycemic index. Mm-hmm. Right? So this the rate. The other piece to this is glycemic load. And so glycemic load now takes into consideration how much carbohydrate you're actually eating, which is really important. So glycemic load, if we compare a watermelon to bagels, watermelon and bagels have the same glycemic index, a 72. So they have the same ability to spike your blood glucose, identical. Yet the effect of it, or the long-term effect of that, is much different, yes, because how much carbohydrate is in a serving of a bagel versus how much carbohydrate is in a serving of watermelon.
A lot more in the bagel than, than the watermelon.
Watermelon's 98% water, so the glycemic load is so much higher in a bagel because you're getting a high concentration of carbohydrate, whereas the watermelon, you got to eat like a quarter of a watermelon to get the same amount of carbohydrate that you'd get in eating a bagel.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the glycemic index doesn't go far enough because it's not taking into consideration how much of the food you're eating. Right, it's telling you how quickly it spikes it, but partly how quickly it spikes it, but how long it lasts. So how long it lasts is going to be based on the glycemic load.
Which is how much you ate.
How much carbohydrate you actually got, not just what was the number of the carbohydrate, right? So the watermelon, you're going to get some. It's going to boost the blood sugar a bit, but it's not going to remain there high for a period of time. Whereas the bagel will have more of that sort of extended effect, but it may lead you up and then stay there and then you may come crashing down as well, yes? Because we like to go up. What we'd really like is just get you high enough that you can stay stable, but not have to go high enough and then you got to come down and you got to go up and you got to come down. But that's happening all the time, right? That's homeodynamics. You can't get around that. So glycemic load is taking into consideration how much you're actually eating of the food or how much carbohydrate you're eating, which I think is really important. And if you look at glycemic load, you're basically just saying, that's how I lower my carbohydrate intake, right? So that's like you're starting to count carbohydrates when you're looking at glycemic load versus glycemic index.
Mm-hmm.
And understand glycemic index is a little bit more palatable by the food industry because it's not based on how much you eat.
Right.
I gave this example, right? So cereal, right? So cornflakes has a really high glycemic index, like 92 or something. The question is, but that 92 is the same whether you ate a half a cup of cornflakes or 3 cups of cornflakes, right? I mean, that number doesn't change how much.
Right.
Glycemic load would completely change based on how much of the food you ate.
Right.
So how much you eat plays a role in this that glycemic index is ignoring.
And no one ever sits down to eat a quarter cup of cereal.
I mean, eating a serving size of cereal, have you ever done that? The only way I would do that is if I got the end of the cereal box and that's all that was left,
right?
Yeah, and who would leave that much anyways? What the person before should have just finished it off.
Yeah.
Yes. It's an extra serving or two. I'm just going to add that. So the glycemic index isn't all of the story, right? It's part of the story. And yes, it's important, but we shouldn't just be driven by following that. And already, as you see, there's some complexity here because you're like, well, wait, if it's sweet, it actually has a lower glycemic index than if it doesn't have sweet in it. But if it's got fat or if it's got more soluble fiber, right? So eating beans and eating, you know, All Bran was an example too. All Bran's got a low glycemic index, right? So we get more fiber in something. Now it's slowing down the rate at which we absorb that into our bloodstream, which is a really good thing.
Mm-hmm.
We want to slow that down. We don't want immediate effect from the food that we eat. We'd rather have it a little bit attenuated.
Yeah.
But understand, the more reactive you are, the more you're going to want to bypass it. You don't want to eat something with fiber when you're trying to rescue your blood glucose.
Right. So moderation is a huge key.
Yeah. And then the last piece, how much time do we have?
We're actually done.
We're done?
Yeah.
I can't talk satiety. Do I have a minute?
I don't know. Talk to James.
I'll have to cut this then. So the satiety index. So the last thing. So satiety index is how does the food make you feel? How does it make you feel full? Right? And so that's another piece that's really important to say, how do I solve the hunger by finding foods that I eat that don't make me hungry? And generally, that's going to be protein.
Protein.
That's going to be carbohydrates by themselves will do that. More fiber. Well, actually, protein and fiber have an effect to be much more satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just the easy thing that you can add to a food or add to a meal that's going to blunt this glycemic response. So you're not so much of a, you may not get that reactive pattern from that. The bad things, which do not cause satiety, are actually when we combine fat and carbohydrates. When fat and carbohydrates are combined together, the satiety is very poor. And the food industry, I would say, knows
junk food, right? That's why you can eat a whole bag of potato chips and totally regret it, but you can do it.
Yeah, but if you ate a potato by itself with nothing on it, you wouldn't eat that much.
No, you'd
be like, oh my gosh, I don't want any more, right? That's what we call sensory-specific satiety, right? But when we mix fat and carbohydrate together, it's a bad combination, right?
Yeah.
We got to get more fiber. We have to eat more protein. Those are the things that really help kind of prevent the roller coaster.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you so much, Paul. And again, remember, if you have any questions, you can show up Saturday, June 10th for his sixth lecture in the Obstacles to Cure. He'll be talking about refined carbohydrates, how to identify and avoid empty calories, but you can always ask questions in the first half hour of Q&A. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Christina.
See you next month.
Bye-bye.